and crew voyaging over the dark face of the sea to places where they speak other languages than ours. Just now to Temise for bronze, and I have a cargo of shining steel. My ship came to land some way from your town, and she lies in the harbour of Rhythron, under Woody Nyon. Let me say that we are family friends, from long ago, if you will only go and ask that fine old gentleman Laertes. They say he does not come to town any more, but keeps far away in the country, in a miserable plight, with one servant, an old woman who gives him something to eat and drink when his poor limbs are tired out with stumbling over the slopes of his vine plot. And now, here I am. They did say he was come home from his travels. Your father, I mean. But I suppose the guards have put something in his way. I tell you, he is not dead yet, that grand man, Odysseus. But he is still alive. A prisoner somewhere in the broad sea, in an island amid the waters. And dangerous men hold him fast, savages who are keeping him, no doubt, against his will. Well now, I will play the prophet and tell you what is in the mind of the immortals, and what I think will come to pass. Although I am no prophet really, and I do not know much about the meaning of birds, I tell you, he will not long be absent from his dear native land, not if chains of iron hold him fast. He will find a way to get back, for he is never at a loss. Come now, please tell me this. I want to know all about you. Are you really his son? A boy as big as you, the son of Odysseus? You seem terribly like him. That head and those fine eyes of yours, I can see him now. For we used to meet ever so often in the old days, before he embarked for Troy, when so many of the best men of the nation sailed away in that fleet. Since then I have not seen Odysseus, and he has not seen me. The boy answered politely, "Very well, sir, I will tell you all about it. My mother says I am his son, but I don't know myself. I never heard of anyone who did know whose son he was. I only wish my father had been a man who lived to grow old upon his own rich acres. But now, there never was mortal man more unlucky than the man whom they call my father, since you ask me the question." Then Athena said, with her bright eyes glinting, "I tell you one thing. The breed will not be inglorious in time to come, when you are what I see, and your mother is Penelopea. Thank God for that. But come now, please, tell me this. Feasting? Company? What does it all mean? What has it to do with you? Banquet or wedding? It is clear that this is no bring-what-you-like picnic. It seems to me they are making themselves very much at home. Lords of all they survey. It is enough to make a man angry to see all this rough behavior if he had any decent feeling." The boy answered at once, "Sir, since you ask me the question, this house might have been wealthy and beyond reproach, so long as that man was at home. But now the gods have willed otherwise. They have chosen to send trouble upon us. That man they have picked out of all the men in the world, and they have made him vanish out of our sight. If he were dead, it would not hurt me so much. If he had fallen before Troy among his comrades, or if he had died in the arms of his friends after he had wound up the war, then the whole nation would have built him a barrow, and he would have won a great name for his son as well in days to come. But now there is not a word of him. The birds of prey have made him their prey. He is gone from sight, gone from hearing, and left anguish and lamentation for me. And that man is not all I have to mourn and lament, since the gods have sent other sorrows to trouble me in this way. All the great men who rule in the islands in Dulichion and Same and woody Zacynthus, and all those who are lords in rocky Ithaca, one and all, they want to marry my mother. And here they are, wasting our wealth. She hates the thought of it, but she neither denies nor dares to make an end of the matter, while they eat me out of house and home. Like enough they will tear me to pieces myself as well." "Insufferable," was the thought of Pallas Athena, and she said, "What a shame! It's clear you do need Odysseus to lay hands on these heartless men who pester his wife. And he is so far away. If only he would come at this moment and stand right in the doorway of this hall with helmet and shield and a couple of spears, looking as he did when I first set eyes upon him in our house, while he drank his wine and enjoyed himself. On his way back from Ephyra, from the house of Ilus Mimerides, he had been all that way in a fast ship, Odysseus, I mean. He was looking for a deadly poison to smear on the barbs of his arrows. The man would not give him any for fear of the everlasting gods, but my father did give him some, for he was terribly fond of him. May he be like what he was then, when he comes upon these rioters. Quick death would be theirs, one and all. They would be sorry they ever wanted to marry. Ah, well, of course, all that lies on the knees of the gods, whether he will come back or not and punish them in his own house. But you had better think how to get them out of the place. That is my advice. Look here now, just listen to me. Tomorrow, call together all the great men of the nation to a meeting. Make them a speech, protest before all the gods. Tell the intruders to make themselves scarce and go home. And your mother, if she has a mind to marry again, let her first go back to her father's house. He is a man of influence. They will arrange the marriage and see that the bridegroom makes a handsome provision for her, such as a beloved daughter ought to have. My advice to you is this, if you will let me advise you. Get the best ship you can find, put 20 oarsmen aboard, go and find out about your father and why he is so long away. Perhaps someone may tell you, or you may hear some rumor that God will send, which is often the best way for people to get news. First go to Pylos and ask that noble Prince Nestor, then to Sparta and Menelaus, good old redhead, for he was the last to come home of all the army. Then if you hear that your father is alive and on his way back, for all your wearing and tearing you can bear up for another year. But if you hear that he is dead and no longer in this world, come back yourself to your own home and build him a barrow and do the funeral honors in handsome style, as you ought, and give away your mother to some husband. When at last all this is finished and done, collect your wits and make a good plan to kill these hangers-on, either by craft or by open fight. Indeed, you ought not to play about in the nursery any longer. Your childhood's days are done. Haven't you heard what a great name Orestes made for himself in the world, the fine young fellow when he killed the traitor Aegisthus, who had murdered his famous father? You too, my dear boy, big and handsome as I see you now, you too, be strong, that you may have a good name on the lips of men for many generations. Now I will go back to my ship and my crew, for they will be tired of waiting for me. It is your own business, so don't forget what I say.
Telemachus listened with his usual good manners. Sir, I thank you for your kindness. You might be a father speaking to his own son, and I will not forget one word of what you say. But do stay a little, even if you are in a hurry. Let me offer you a bath, rest and refresh yourself, and take back to your ship a gift from me, something precious, a real good thing, to be an heirloom from me, such as a friend gives to a friend. Then the goddess Athena answered,
Don't keep me longer, I want to be off. As to any gift which your kind heart bids you offer, when I come back you may give it me to take home. If you choose me a good one, you shall have as good in return.
When Athena had said this, away she went like a bird, up through the luffer in the roof. In the spirit of the boy she left courage and confidence, and he thought of his father even more than before. He understood what it all meant, and he was amazed, for he believed her to be a god. At once he went back to that rough crew, looking more like a god than a man himself. He found the minstrel singing to them in fine style, while they sat all round in silence, listening. He sang of the lamentable return of the Achaeans from Troy, which Pallas Athena had laid upon them. In the upper chamber, the wonderful sounds fell on the ears of Penelopea, the daughter of Icarius, the wise and faithful wife. She came down the high staircase out of her room, but Not alone, two waiting women went with her. And when this lovely creature came amongst the men who would have her for a wife, she stood by the doorpost of the great hall with its massive walls, and drew the soft veil over her cheeks. There she stood, with one honest waiting woman on each side. Tears were in her eyes, as she spoke to the singer of that divine song. "Phemius, you know many other songs fit to charm the ear, great deeds of men and gods, which singers are used to noise abroad. Sing one of those to the company, and let them drink their wine in silence. But make an end to this piteous song, which tears the heartstrings in my breast, since I beyond all have had to suffer grief intolerable. So dear is he that I long for and never forget, my husband, whose fame is known over the length and breadth of the land."
Telemachus answered her with good sense. "My dear mother, why don't you let the worthy minstrel entertain us as he likes? Don't blame the minstrel. Blame Zeus, who makes men work hard for their living, and then gives them just what he chooses for each. As for the minstrel, there is no harm in his singing the bad luck of the Danians. The song people praise is always the latest thing. You should brace up your heart and mind to listen. Odysseus was not the only one who never saw the day of return from Troy. Many other good fellows were lost, too. Go to your room and see about your own business, loom and distaff, and keep the servants to their work. Talking is always the man's part, and mine in particular, for the man rules the house."
She was astonished to hear him, and went back to her room, but she noticed how sensibly her son had spoken. When she was upstairs with the servants, she wept for Odysseus, her beloved husband, until Athena laid sweet sleep upon her eyelids.
But the pretenders made quite an uproar in the shadowy hall, and each one might be heard praying loudly that she might share his bed. Then Telemachus made them a speech.
"Gentlemen, you pretend to marry my mother, but you are behaving in a most outrageous fashion. For this once, let us eat and drink and be merry, but let there be no shouting. For it's a fine thing to hear a man sing when he has a heavenly voice like this. Then tomorrow let us hold session in the marketplace, for I wish to tell you in plain words that you must go from my house. Lay your dinners elsewhere, and eat your own food in your own houses, change and change about. Well, if you think it meet and right to consume one man's goods without paying, carve away. I will appeal to the everlasting gods, and see if Zeus may one day grant me vengeance. There would be no ransom then. In this house you should perish."
As he said this, they all bit their lips. They were surprised to hear how boldly Telemachus spoke.
Antinous rose to answer him. His father was the soft-spoken Eupeithes. "Why, Telemachus, you must have gone to school with the gods. They have taught you their fine rhetoric and bold style. I do hope Cronion will never make you king of our island of Ithaca to sit in the seat of your fathers."
Telemachus took him up neatly and said, "I dare say it might annoy you, Antinous, but I should be glad to accept the gift. Do you think it the worst thing in the world to be a king? It is not a bad thing at all. He gets plenty of wealth, he is highly honored. But of course there are other kings in our nation, not a few in this island, young and old, and one of them might perhaps have the place of that great man Odysseus, as he is dead. But then I will at least be master of my own house and my own servants, which my great father won for me." Now Eurymachus of Polybus answered him,
"Telemachus, it lies on the knees of the gods, you may be quite sure, who is to be king over the people in our island of Ithaca. But your property I hope you may keep for yourself and be master in your own house. I pray that no man may ever come to force you against your will and rob you of your property so long as Ithaca is a place to live in. But I do beg you, my good sir, tell me about that stranger. Where that man came from, what country he claims, where he was born, who in the world he is. Does he bring a rumor of your father's return? Did some private business send him here like this? How he jumped up, gone in a moment, and did not wait for us to make his acquaintance. Certainly he did not look a bad sort of fellow."
Telemachus answered him, "Eurymachus, I am sure my father will never see home again. I believe no rumors any more, wherever they come from. I take no notice of any divinations if my mother calls in a diviner and asks him questions. That is an old family friend from Taphus. He says he is Mentes, the son of a clever father, Anchialus, prince of the seafaring Taphians." That is what he said. But in his heart he knew the immortal goddess. So they turned to dancing and joyous singing and made merry. They were still at it when the darkness of evening came on them. Then off they went, each to his home and bed. And Telemachus went up to bed in his room, which was built high up over the wide courtyard, with a view all round, and his heart was full of thoughts. To light him on the way, a faithful old servant carried a blazing torch. She was Eurycleia, daughter of Opsipocenerides. Laertes had bought her long ago at his own cost when she was in her first youth, and he gave 20 oxen for her. He treated her as well as he did his own faithful wife, but he did not lie with her, for he wanted to avoid any quarrel with his wife. This was the woman who carried the torch for Telemachus. She loved him more than any other of the household, and she had been his nurse when he was a little tot. He opened the door of the handsome room and sat down on the bed and stripped off his soft shirt, which he gave into the wise old woman's hands. She folded it up and smoothed it out and hung it on a peg beside the bed frame and left the room, pulling the door to by the silver crow's beak, and ran home the bolt by pulling the strap. There, all night long, covered up with a soft fleece of wool, he thought over the journey which Athena had told him to go.
Book 2. How the Council Met in the Marketplace of Ithaca, and What Came of It. Dawn came, showing her rosy fingers through the early mists, and Telemachus leapt out of bed. He dressed himself, slung a sharp sword over his shoulder, strapped a stout pair of boots on his lissome feet, and came forth from his chamber like a young god. He called the criers at once and told them to use their good lungs in summoning the people to council. The criers did their part, and the people came. As soon as they were assembled, he went down to the council himself with a strong spear in his hand and a couple of dogs for company, which danced round him as he walked. He was full of enchanting grace, and the people stared at him in admiration. Not for nothing Athena was his friend. He took his seat in his father's place, and the reverend seniors made room. The first speaker was Aegyptius, a great gentleman, bent with age and full of ripe wisdom. He also had lost a son, who had sailed with Prince Odysseus in the fleet to Ilius, Antiphus the Lancer. The savage Cyclops had killed him in the cave. In fact, he was the monster's last supper. Three other sons the old man had. One of them, Eurynomus, was among the wooers, and two kept their father's farms. But he could not forget the other, whom he mourned unceasingly, and now there were tears in his eyes for his son's sake, as he began to speak.
"Listen to me, men of Ithaca, for I have something to say to you. There has been no session of our council since the time when Prince Odysseus sailed with the fleet. And now, who has summoned us? Is it a young man or one of the elders? Was it some private need that moved him? Or has he news of some threatening raid and now wishes to report what he was the first to hear? Or is there some other public matter which he wishes to bring before us? He has done well, I think, and deserves our thanks. I pray Zeus may grant him that blessing which his heart desires."
These words seemed a good omen to Telemachus and encouraged him. He made no delay, for he was eager to speak, so he stood up before the council. The speaker's staff was put in his hand by Pasenor, the public crier. Then Telemachus first addressed himself to the old counselor. "The man you call for is not far away, reverend sir, who summoned the people together, as you shall soon know. I am that man, and I am in great trouble of my own. There is no news of a threatening raid to report. I have no advantage of you there, and there is no other public matter which I wish to bring before you. This is my own private need, trouble which has fallen upon my house. Two troubles, indeed. First, I have lost a good father, who once was king over you that are present here, and he was like a kind father to you. And now, again, there is something much worse, which I tell you will soon utterly tear to pieces my whole house, and destroy my whole living. My mother is besieged by those who would marry her against her will, own sons, to those men who are chief among you here. They will not go near her father's house and lay a formal proposal before Icarius. The thought makes them shiver, for then he might collect the bridal gifts for his daughter and give her to the man of his choice, the one he likes best. No, it is our house they visit regularly, every day, kill our cattle and sheep and fat goats, hold high revel, and drink my sparkling wine, quite reckless. That is the way it all goes. For there is no man at the head, no one like Odysseus, to drive this curse from the house. You see, we are not able to drive it away ourselves. Sorry, champions, we shall prove, if we try, we have little skill for the combat. Indeed, I would defend myself if I had the strength. What they have done is quite intolerable. There is no decent excuse for the ruin they have made of my house. You ought to be ashamed in your own hearts. You ought to think what others will say about it, our neighbors who live all round us. You should fear the wrath of the gods, who may be provoked by such wickedness to turn upon you. I appeal to Olympian Zeus and Themis, who dissolves the parliaments of men and summons them. Let me be, my friends. Leave me alone to be worn out by my bitter sorrow. Unless I must suppose that my father Odysseus, my good father, was a cruel man and ill-treated the nation, and that is why you are cruel and ill-treat me out of revenge, why you encourage these men. I should like it better if you would eat up my treasures and my flocks. If you would eat them up, perhaps there might be some redress. Then we might go round the town dunning you, imploring, demanding our goods again, till you should give all back. But now I am helpless. All I can do is to suffer the humiliations which you heap upon me. He spoke angrily, and now he dropped down the staff on the ground and burst into tears. All the people were sorry for him, and they all sat silent. Not one had the heart to say an unkind word in reply. Only Antinous answered, and said, "You are a boaster, Telemachus, and you don't know how to keep your temper. What a speech! Cry shame on us! Fasten the blame on us! That's what you want to do. Blame us, indeed! Your own mother is at fault. You cannot find fault with us for paying court to your mother. She is a clever piece indeed. It is 3 years already, and the fourth will soon go by, since she has been deluding the wits of the whole nation. Hopes for all, promises for every man by special messenger, and what she means is something quite different. Here is the latest trick which came out of her meditations. She set up a great warp on her loom in the mansion and wove away, fine work and wide across, and this is what she told us. Young men who seek my hand, now that Odysseus is dead, I know you are in a hurry for marriage, but wait until I finish this cloth, for I don't want to waste all the thread I have spun. It is a shroud for my lord Laertes against the time when all-destroying fate shall carry him away in dolorous death. I should not like the women of our nation to cry scandal if he should lie without a winding sheet when he had great possessions. That is what she said, and we swallowed our pride and consented. There she was all day long working away at the great web. But at night she used to unravel it by torchlight. So for 3 years she deluded the whole nation, and they believed her. But the seasons passed on, and the fourth year began, and a time came when one of her women told us, one who knew the secret. We caught her unraveling that fine web. So, oh, she had to finish it, because she must, not because she would. And as for you, this is the answer of those who pay court to your mother, a plain answer to you and to all the nation. Send your mother out of the house.
Tell her to marry whichever her father says, whichever she likes herself. But if she will go on and on teasing the young men of our nation, with her head full of pride to think how Athena has been generous to her beyond all others, given her skill in beautiful work and good intelligence, and cleverness such as never was heard of, even in the old stories. Those women of our nation who lived long ago with their lovely hair, Tyro, Alcmene, Mycenae with her fine coronals, not one of them had the clever wits of Penelope. But this clever turn was a wicked trick. To put it plainly, we will go on eating up your living in substance just so long as God allows her to keep the mind she has now. She is making a great name for herself, but for you, goodbye to a great fortune. As for us, we will not go to our lands or anywhere else before she marries whoever may please her best out of the nation."
The boy stood up to him and said, "Antinous, it is impossible for me to turn out of doors the mother who bore me and brought me up. My father is somewhere in the world, alive or dead, and it is a hard thing for me to pay back all that dowry to Icarius if I should send away my mother of my own will. Her father will be bad enough, but heaven will send me worse, for my mother will call down the dread avengers upon me if she leaves home, and men will reproach me, so I will never say that word. And if your own minds have any fear of such a reproach, go out of my house, get your dinners elsewhere, eat your own food turn by turn in your own houses. But if you think it meet and right to consume one man's goods without paying, carve away. I will appeal to the everlasting gods and see whether Zeus may not one day grant me vengeance. There would be no ransom then. In that house you should perish." So spoke Telemachus. And Zeus, whose eye can see what is far off, sent him a pair of eagles flying from a lofty mountain peak. On they flew down the wind a while, side by side, soaring on wide-stretched sails. But when they came right over the place of debate, they took a turn round. Then, hovering with quick-beating wings, they stared down on the heads of all with death in their eyes. And tearing at their cheeks and necks with their talons, away they darted to the east, across the houses of the town. The people were amazed when they saw this sight with their own eyes, and they pondered in their hearts what was to come of it. Then up and spoke a noble old man, Halitherses Masterides, for there was no man of his day who came near him in knowledge of birds or in telling what omens meant. He spoke to them in this fashion, out of an honest heart.
"Hear me now, men of Ithaca, for I have something to say. I speak especially to those who would wed, for upon them a great woe is rolling. Odysseus will not long keep away from his friends, but I think he is already near planting the seed of death and destruction for all these men. Trouble there will be also for many others of us who live in the island of Ithaca. But let us consider in good time how we can stop these men, or let them stop themselves, indeed, the sooner the better. I am no novice in prophecy. That is something I understand. As for that man, I declare that all has been fulfilled as I told him when our people embarked for Ilios, and with them went Odysseus, the man who is ready for anything and everything. I said he would have many troubles and lose all his companions, and after 20 long years, unknown, he would come home again. And see now, all is being fulfilled. Then another man got up, Eurymachus, and he said,
"Off with you, old man, go home and prophesy to your children, or they may come to grief some time. In this matter, I am a better prophet than you are. Any number of birds are flying about under the sun, and not all of them are birds of omen. At any rate, Odysseus is dead, far away from this place. And I wish you had died with him. Then you would not be here making a long speech as God's mouthpiece. You would not unleash this angry Telemachus. No doubt you expect to find something from him when you get home, if he doesn't forget it. But I tell you this, and I will do it, too. He is a young man, and you are full of antediluvian wisdom, but if you cajole him and inflame his passions, he shall be the first to suffer. As for you, sir, there will be damages which you will be sorry to pay. A heavy burden shall be yours. For Telemachus, this is my advice, which I give before you all. Let him tell his mother to go home to her father's house. They will arrange a marriage and collect the bridal gifts, plenty of them, as many as there ought to be for a beloved daughter. For I do not think the young men will cease their importunate wooing until that is done, since we fear no one in any case, not Telemachus, certainly, for all his flood of words. And we care nothing for your prognostications, respected sir. They will come to nothing, and only make you more of a nuisance than you were. Yes, his wealth shall be wasted and consumed, and there shall be no retribution, as long as that woman keeps putting off her wedding and wasting our time. Here we are, waiting day after day, rivals for a great prize. Never look at another woman, when you would expect each man to go a-wooing for himself.
But Telemachus still kept his wits about him, and he replied, Eurymachus, and all you other gentlemen who pay court to my mother, I make no more appeal to you. I have no more to say, for now the gods know, and all the nation. But I beg you to lend me a swift ship and 20 men to carry me there and back, for I am going to Sparta and sandy Pylos to find out about my father and why he is so long away. Perhaps someone may tell me, or I may hear some rumor that God will send, which is often the best way for people to get news. Then if I hear that my father is alive and on his way back, for all my wearing and tearing I can bear up for another year. But if I hear he is dead and no longer in the world, I will come back to my own home and build him a barrow and do the funeral honors in handsome style as I ought, and give away my mother to another husband. He said his say and sat down. Then uprose Mentor, friend and comrade of the excellent Odysseus, to whom Odysseus had entrusted his whole house when he sailed away. They were to obey the old man, and he was to keep all safe. This is what he said, and very good sense it was.
Listen to me, men of Ithaca, and hear what I have to say. Let no man henceforth take the trouble to be kind and gentle, no sceptred prince. Let none try to be fair and right, but let him be always harsh and do what he ought not to do. Since no one remembers the noble Odysseus, not one out of all the people he ruled like a kind father. I do not grudge it the proud men who pay their court, if they act with violence in the mischievous bodgery of their minds. They stake their own heads when they devour the house of Odysseus with violence and think he will never come back. But now it is you, the others, who make me ashamed. How you all sit, mum, when you ought to denounce them and hold back a few young men, when you are many. Leocritus Euenorides answered him, Mentor, you mischief-maker, you madman, what a thing to say. Drive them on to stop us. One against many is done, and many is too many for one in fights for a supper. Why, even Odysseus himself, if he came back to Ithaca and found a sturdy company feasting in his own house and thought of driving them out of hall, his wife would have little satisfaction, however much she may have missed him, but then and there he would die an ugly death if he's one against many. What you say is all wrong. Come now, men, make yourselves scarce. Away to your lands, every one. As for this fellow, Mentor shall help him with his voyage, and Halitherses, since they have been friends of the family for ages. But I think he will have to sit here for a good long time and wait for his news in Ithaca. He will never bring off that voyage.
With these words he broke up the assembly forthwith. They all made themselves scarce and went each to his own house, and the pretenders went back to the house of Odysseus. But Telemachus went by himself to the seashore. There he washed his hands in the grey brine and offered a prayer to Athena. Hear me, thou who yesterday didst come a god into our house, who didst bid me take ship over the misty sea and inquire if my father is coming home and why he is so long away. All this the people prevent, but most of all my mother's wooers, men full of wicked pride."
Such was his prayer.
And Athena came to his side,
like Mentor, in shape and voice.
She spoke to him, and the words were plain and pointed.
"You will not lack either courage or sense in the future, Telemachus, for we can see now that there is a drop in you of your father's fine spirit. What a man he was, to make good both deed and word. I tell you, your journey shall not be hindered or stopped. But if you are not his son and Penelope's, then I do not expect you to succeed in what you wish to do. Few sons, let me tell you, are like their fathers. Most are worse, a few are better. But since you will lack neither courage nor sense in the future, and since the mind of Odysseus has not wholly failed in you, there is hope for the future, and I tell you that you will succeed. Think no more now of the plots and plans of those who woo your mother, for there is neither sense nor justice in them. They know nothing of the death and destruction which is near them, so that in one day they shall all perish. But the journey which you desire shall not be long delayed, when you have with you such an old friend of your father as I am, for I will provide a swift ship and go with you myself. You must just go home and mingle with the company, get provisions ready and put them all up in vessels, wine in jars and barley meal, which is the marrow of men in strong skins. I will go at once and collect volunteers among the people. There are many ships in the island of Ithaca, both new and old. I will look round and find you the best, and we will make all ready and launch her upon the broad sea."
So spoke Athena, daughter of Zeus. And Telemachus did not stay long after he heard what the goddess said. He set out for the house with a heavy heart. And he found the proud pretenders there, skinning goats and singeing fat pigs in the courtyard.
Antinous laughed and made straight for Telemachus and grasped his hand and called him by name and said, "You are a boaster, Telemachus, and you don't know how to keep your temper. Do not trouble your head about plots and plans, but just go on eating and drinking as usual. Our people will manage all you want, I'm sure, a ship and the best crew to be found. They will give you a quick passage to Sandy Pylos if you want to hear news of your father."
Telemachus pulled his hand from the hand of Antinous and said, "Antinous, with your friends rioting all round, it is impossible to enjoy a meal in peace and quiet. Is it not enough, men, that you have been carving up a good portion of my possessions all this time, while I was still a boy? But now, you see, I am grown up, and I hear everyone talking about it, and so I find things out. Now I feel my own strength, and I mean to do my best to bring retribution upon you when I come back from Pylos, or now in this country. I mean to go, and no one shall prevent me, even if I must go as a passenger, since I am not to have my own ship and crew. I suppose that suited you better." When he said this, the others mocked and jeered at him, and you might hear one of the young bullies saying,
"Clear enough, Telemachus has murder in his mind. He will bring help from Pylos, or maybe from Sparta, since he is so terribly set on it. Or perhaps he wants to go as far as Ephyra, to bring some deadly poison from that rich land and put it in the cup and kill us all."
Another of the young bullies would say,
"Ah, but who knows? Once aboard ship he may be carried far from his friends and perish, just like Odysseus. That would double our trouble, for we should have to divide all his goods among us. But we would give the house to his mother for herself and the man who would marry her."
So much for them. But Telemachus went down to his father's storehouse, a room lofty and wide, where heaps of gold and bronze were kept, with clothes in coffers and plenty of fragrant oil. Jars of delicious old wine stood there, full of that divine drink without a drop of water. There they stood in rows along the wall, ready for Odysseus, when he should come home again after all his troubles. The place was closed in by double doors, right and tight. The housekeeper was on the spot day and night, and she took care of everything, And a very clever woman she was, Eurycleia, the daughter of Ops Pacenorides. Telemachus called her to the storehouse and said, "Come, Nanny, draw me some kegs of this fine wine, the nicest you have, next to that which you keep so carefully for your noble master, unhappy man. All ready in case he should come from somewhere or other, if he can get clear of death and ruin. Fill me a dozen, and put a stopper on each. And a few skinfuls of barley meal, good skins, properly stitched, 20 measures of good barley meal ground in the millstones. Keep this to yourself, and let all the stuff be put ready together. This evening I mean to fetch it away, as soon as Mother has gone upstairs to bed, for I am off to Sparta and sandy Pylos, to see if I can hear any news of my father." When he said this, his dear old nurse cried aloud in distress, and said, in her downright way,
"What on earth put that into thy head, love? Why wilt thou go to foreign parts, and thine only son, and reet well loved? He's dead, far away from home, my blessed Odysseus, in some foreign land. Aye, and if thou goest, they'll up and plot mischief against the by-and-by, to murder thee by some trick, and all that's here they will share among em. Stay thee where thou bist. Sit down on the property. What's the sense of wandering over the barren sea and maybe happening an accident?"
Telemachus only said, "Cheer up, Nanny. This is God's will, let me tell you. Now promise me on your oath not to say a word to Mother for 10 or 12 days, unless she asks herself and hears I have gone, or you'll have her crying and spoiling her pretty skin." When he said that, she took her oath, and this done with all due solemnity, she wasted no time, drew off the wine into kegs, packed the barley meal in the skins right and tight. Then Telemachus went off and joined the roisterers. Meanwhile, the goddess Athena was doing the rest. She took on the form of Telemachus and tramped the length and breadth of the city, took aside each of the men and told her tale, then directed them to meet in the evening beside the cutter. The boat itself she begged of Noemon, the sturdy son of Phrontius, and he agreed with all his heart. The sun went down and the streets were all darkened. Then Athena ran the boat down into the sea, and put in all the gear that ships carry for sailing and rowing. She moored her at the harbor point, and the crew assembled, fine young fellows all, and she set them each to work. But she had something else to do. She made her way to the house of Odysseus, and there she distilled sweet sleep upon them all, and dazed them as they drank, until they let the cups drop out of their hands. So they got up and went to find sleep, dispersing all over the city, for they did not sit long after sleep fell on their eyelids. Then Athena called out Telemachus in front of the great hall, taking the shape and voice of Mentor, and said to him, "Telemachus, your men are all ready and furnished cap-a-pie, sitting at the oars, waiting for you to start. Come, let us go and waste no time about it." With these words she led the way briskly, and he followed in her footsteps. And when they came to the ship in the seaside, there he found the bushy-headed boys on the beach, and he spoke to them, full of dignity and strength. "This way, friends. Let us fetch the provisions. They are all ready and waiting in the house. My mother knows nothing about it, nor any of the servants, but only one single soul has heard our plan." So he led the way, and they went with him. They carried all the stuff down to the ship and put it on board, as Telemachus told them to do. Telemachus himself went on board, following Athena. She took her seat on the poop, and he sat beside her. The others cast off the hawsers, and themselves came on board and sat down on the benches. Athena, with her bright eyes glinting, sent them a following wind right from the west, piping over the purple sea. Then Telemachus called to the men and told them to put a hand to the tackling. They lifted the mast and stepped it in its hollow box, made it fast with the forestays, hauled up the white sail by its ropes of twisted leather. The wind blew full into the bellying sail, and the dark wave boomed about the stem of the ship as she went. So on she sped, shouldering the swell, traveling steadily on her way. When they had made snug all the tackle about the ship, they set before them brimming bowls of wine. and poured libations to the gods immortal and everlasting, but most of all to the bright-eyed daughter of Zeus. So, all night long, and in the dawning, the ship cut her way. Book 3. What Happened in Sandy Pylos. The sun leapt out of the lovely bay high into the brazen sky to give light to the deathless gods and to mortal men all over the fruitful earth. And they came to Pylos, the stately city of Neleus. The people were on the shore sacrificing jet-black bulls to the blue-crested god who shakes the earth. There were 9 messes, 500 sitting in each mess, and 9 bulls were laid out before each. They had already distributed the tripes, and they were burning the thigh pieces for the god when the ship came sailing in. The crew brailed up the sail and trussed it, and moored ship and went ashore. Telemachus came ashore, too, after Athena, who broke the silence by saying, "Telemachus, there is no need to be shy, not a bit. You know why you have come on this voyage, to ask news of your father, how he died and where he was buried. Come along, then, straight to Nestor. Let us learn what he really thinks and knows about it. You must speak to Nestor yourself and ask him to tell you the whole truth. He has too much good feeling to deceive you." Telemachus answered, "Mentor, how can I go? How can I greet him? I have no practice in polite speeches. Then again, a young man must be shy when he addresses an older man." Athena, with a glance of her keen eyes, replied, "Some things you will think of yourself, Telemachus. Some things God will put into your mind. Not without the blessing of heaven were you born and bred, I think." With these words, Pallas Athena led the way briskly, and he followed. They came to the place where the Pylians were all gathered in their messes. There was Nestor, sitting with his sons, and all around were his companions preparing the feast with meat broiling and grilling on the spits. When they saw the strangers, they came up in a body and welcomed them and bade them be seated. Nestor's son Peisistratus reached them first. He grasped both their hands and seated them in front of the spread upon soft fleeces laid on the sands beside his brother Thrasymedes and his father. Then he gave them their plates of tripe and chitterlings and poured wine into a golden cup. He raised his cup and called upon Pallas Athena, daughter of Zeus Almighty, and said, "Pray now, sir, to Lord Poseidon, who owns this feast which you have happened to join. When you have poured your drops and offered your prayer as usual, pass on the cup to your friend. He too, I think, will join our prayer to the immortals, for all men need the gods. But he is younger, he is of my own age, so I will give you the golden chalice first." So saying, he put the cup full of delicious wine in her hands. Athena was pleased that he knew what was proper, and gave her the golden goblet first. At once she prayed earnestly to Lord Poseidon. "Hear me, Poseidon Earthshaker, and grudge not to accomplish these things for us who pray to thee. To Nestor first and his sons vouchsafe renown, and next to all the Pylians besides grant a gracious requital for this splendid sacrifice, and grant that Telemachus and I may have a safe return when we have done that for which we came hither with our swift black ship." And while she prayed, she was doing her part to fulfill it. Then she passed the fine two-handled cup to Telemachus, and the son whom Odysseus loved made his prayer. The others took the broiled meat off the spits and distributed the portions, and all had a famous feast. But when they had taken as much as they wanted, the old cavalier Nestor addressed them.
"That is better. And now I may be allowed to put a few questions to my guests and ask who they are, since they have enjoyed their meal in peace. Who are you, sirs? Where do you come from over the waters? Is it business, or are you voyaging at random, like the sea robbers who voyage about and risk their lives to bring trouble in foreign parts?"
Telemachus now plucked up courage, for Athena herself gave him the courage to ask about his father's delay, that he might show he knew how to behave in society. He said, "May it please your majesty, Nestor Neleides, you ask where we come from, and I will answer. We come from Ithaca and the town under Mount Neon. My business is private, not public. I seek any news I can hear anywhere in the wide world of my father, the noble Odysseus, the ever-patient man who they say fought by your side when you took Troy. We have heard about all the others who were in the war. We know where each of them died, to our sorrow. But as for that man, we have not even heard that he is dead. Such is the will of Cronion. For no one can tell us for certain when he died, whether he was brought low on land by his enemies or at sea amid the billows of Amphitrite. That is why I am here to appeal to you. Tell me, if you please, of his lamentable fate, if you saw it with your own eyes, or if you have heard anyone speak of him on his wanderings. For he was born to sorrow, if any man ever was. And do not soften your words out of pity to spare me, but tell me plainly what you saw of him. I beseech you, if ever in word or deed my honorable father made you a promise and did it before Troy, where you Achaeans suffered so much, remember that now for my sake, and tell me the truth.
My dear boy, answered the fine old cavalier, how you bring it all back to me. What we reckless fellows did go through, how we ranged over the misty seas in our ships for plunder, wherever Achilles led us, how we fought round the great city of King Priam. Ah, there and then all our best men were slain. There lies Aeus, the man of war. There lies Achilles. There is Patroclus, prudent as a god in council. There is my own dear son, a man strong and without blemish, Antilochus, swift of foot beyond all, and a fighter. And what a world of troubles we suffered besides these. What mortal man could tell them all? Not if you would stay here 5 long years or 6 long years could you hear the whole story of the troubles which the brave Achaeans there endured. You would soon be tired and go back to your own country. 9 long years we were busy, scheming and plotting and planning in every possible way, and only just managed it, thanks be to God. All that time no one came near Odysseus in resource, for that grand man was first by a long way in all plots and plans and schemes. Your father, I say, if you are really his son. If! You amaze me, young man. When I hear you speak, I might be hearing him. You could not imagine a young man could speak so like him. All that time I and Odysseus never took different sides, either in parliament or in council. We were of one mind. With good sense and wisdom we advised the people always that which promised the best success. Again, when we had sacked the tall city of Troy and embarked, and God scattered the fleet, then Zeus ordained a lamentable homecoming for us. For not all were sensible and fair-minded, and so a great many of them drew upon themselves an evil fate from the destroying wrath of the bright-eyed daughter of the thundering father, who made a quarrel between the two princes of the house of Atreus. When these two called the people to parliament, quite wrong, most improper, at sunset of all times, and they all came, heavy with wine, the two of them explained why they had summoned the people. Then Menelaus advised them to see about the return voyage, and Agamemnon did not like it at all. He wanted to keep the people back and to make solemn sacrifice, hoping to calm the dire anger of Athenia. Poor fool! He did not know that he was not likely to yield, for the mind of the everlasting gods is not quickly turned. So there the two stood, bandying angry words. All the men-at-arms jumped up, and there was the devil of a noise in the place, as each backed his own opinion. All through the night there was a lull, but the angry passions remained, for Zeus was preparing an unhappy issue from this trouble. Then, at dawn, some of us launched our ships and put our goods on board with the captive women dressed in their best. About half stayed on shore with King Agamemnon. Half of us embarked and rowed away. Quickly the ships ran on, for God made smooth the great billows of the deep. We came to Tenedos and offered sacrifice there to the gods, longing to get home. But Zeus had no thought yet of home for us. Hard, God, to put a quarrel among us again for the second time.
There some turned back their ships. A fine, trim-built lot they were, led by Prince Odysseus, for that deep and clever man wished to take the side of Agamemnon once more. But I went on with all the ships that were left, since I knew that Providence had trouble in store for them. With me went the warrior Diomedes, and he brought his companions. Then, better late than never, Menelaus came after us and caught us up at Lesbos, while we were hesitating about the long voyage straight across, whether to go seaward of rocky Chios, close along the island of Syria, keeping the island on our left, or inside of Chios, past windy Mimas. We prayed God to show us a portent, and he showed us one, and told us to cut straight across the sea to Euboea, that we might escape our troubles the quickest way. A whistling wind began to blow, the ships ran at a great rate over the water, and in the night they put in at Geristus. There we sacrificed many rump slices of bulls to Poseidon, in thanks for traversing that long stretch of sea. It was the fourth day when the party of Diomedes Tydides brought their fine ships to harbour in Argos, but I held on for Pylos, and the wind never fell from the time when the god first let it out to blow. So I came home, my dear boy, without news, and I know nothing of the others who were saved of the army or those who were lost. But all the news I get while I sit in my hall you shall hear, as is right and proper, and I will not hide anything. There was a good return for the Myrmidons, they say, those champion spearmen who were led by the doughty son of proud Achilles, a good return for Philoctetes, the famous son of Poeas. All the company of Idomeneus were brought back safe to Crete, all who survived the war, and the sea did not take one of them. But Agamemnon you have heard of yourselves, although you live far away. How he came back, and how Aegisthus plotted a pitiable death for him. Well, he paid for it, sure enough, in horrible fashion. What a good thing it is that a son should be on the spot when a man is dead. That son, you see, took vengeance upon his father's murderer, the traitor Aegisthus, who killed his famous father. You too, my friend, be brave, for I see you are handsome and tall, and then those to be born in future generations will praise you.
Telemachus answered, "May it please your majesty, Nestor Neleides, he did indeed take his vengeance, and his fame shall be carried down in the world for many generations to come. How I wish that the gods would invest me with power as great as his to take vengeance on the men who woo my mother for their outrageous violence, for the intolerable insults of their scheming brains. But no, the spinner has spun me no such happiness for my father and me. We must just be patient, come what may."
Then Nestor answered, "My friend, since you have spoken of it yourself and recalled it to my memory, they do say that there are a great number of men in your house seeking your mother's hand in marriage against your will, full of evil schemes. Tell me, do you submit willingly to this? Do all the people dislike you because of something said by the voice of God? Who knows if some day he may come and take vengeance for their violence, whether alone or all the people with him? If only Athena Brighteyes would choose to show her love to you as she used to care for that glorious man Odysseus in the Trojan land among all those hardships which our nation had to suffer, for never have I seen the love of the gods so manifestly shown as when Pallas Athena stood manifestly by his side. If only she would show love to you like that and care for you, many a one of them would have something else than weddings to think of."
Telemachus answered, "Sir, I do not think that will happen yet. What you say is too great. It amazes me. Never could I hope for that, even if it should be the will of God."
Then Athena said, "Telemachus, what words you have let slip between your teeth. It is easy for God to bring a man safely home, if it be his will, even from a long way off. I would choose to suffer great tribulations and then live to return home, rather than to return safely and then die beside my hearth, as Agamemnon did by the treachery of Aegisthus and his own wife. But death is the common lot, which not even gods can keep from a man they love, as soon as the lamentable fate of dolorous death gets hold of him. Then Telemachus answered, "Let us say no more of this, Mentor, although we are not free from sorrow. The day of his return can never dawn, but the immortals have already ordained death for him and a black fate. Now there is something else I want to ask Nestor, since he knows men's manners and minds better than others do. They say he has been king through 3 generations of men, so that he has quite the look of an immortal to me. Nestor Neleides, tell me the truth. How came my lord King Agamemnon to die? Where was Menelaus? How did the traitor Aegisthus manage to murder him, since the murdered man was far stronger? Was he not in his own city of Argos? Or was he somewhere else, and so the man took courage and killed him?" Nestor answered him, "Indeed, I will tell you the whole truth, my boy. Surely you can surmise yourself what would have happened if Aegisthus had been found in the place by King Menelaus when he came from Troy. Dead he would have been. Not a clod of earth dropped upon him, but dogs and vultures would have torn his corpse to pieces, thrown on the ground outside the city walls. Not a woman in the whole nation would have wept for him, for it was a monstrous crime he plotted. We were over there doing our arduous duties, firmly fixed. He, at his ease, in a corner of that land of horses, bewitching Agamemnon's wife forever with his talk. At first, she would have nothing to do with the shameful business. I mean, Queen Clytemnestra, for she was not really a bad woman. And there was that singing man by her side, who was put in full trust by Agamemnon when he went to Troy to look after his wife. But when the chains of fate bound her fast, and she must needs be mastered, then the man took his minstrel to a desert island and left him prey and plaything for the carrion birds. And the woman he took to his own house, one as willing as the other. Many thank offerings he burnt on the god's holy altars, many precious things he cast into the fire, woven stuffs and gold, for success in a great enterprise which he had never in his heart expected to carry out. Well then, we both set out from Troy, Menelaus and I, in great contentment together. But when we came to holy Zunion, the headland of Attica, Phoebus Apollo attacked the helmsman of Menelaus, and slew him with his gentle shafts, while the man held the steering oar between his hands, and the ship was running free. That was Phrontis Onetorides, champion of the world when the stormy winds do blow. So for all his haste to go on, he stayed there until he could bury his comrade and perform the funeral rites. But when he followed us over the Purple Sea, and the ships came in their course to the steep cliff of Malea, Zeus Almighty decreed a hard road for him to travel. He poured out a hurricane of whistling winds and monstrous swollen waves mountain high. Then he cut the fleet in two and brought part of them to Crete, where the Sidonians are settled about the stream of Viardinus. There is a smooth cliff running down steep into the sea at the verge of Gorton, over the misty deep where the wind from the southwest drives a great wave against the western headlands up towards Phaestus, and a little bit of stone keeps off the great wave. So far they came, and then the men escaped death with great trouble, but the ships were all smashed to pieces on those rocks by the sea. The other ships, 5 in number, were driven to Egypt by wind and water. While Menelaus was there collecting a heap of gold and commodities and sailing his fleet about into foreign parts, that was the time when Aegisthus was making his murderous plans at home. And after he killed Agamemnon, he reigned 7 years in all the wealth of Mycenae, while the people were cowed under his rule. But in the 8th year came his ruin. Prince Orestes came back from Athens and killed his father's murderer, the traitor Aegisthus, because he had killed his famous father. When Orestes had killed him, he gave a funeral feast to the people over his hateful mother and Aegisthus the coward. And on that very day arrived that stout champion Menelaus, with a heap of wealth filling his ships. Now, my friend, don't go a-roaming too long, far away from home, and desert your property, and leave those blustering fellows in your house like that, or they will eat up everything and share your wealth among themselves, and your journey will end in nothing. Go to Menelaus, that is my advice and bidding. He has lately come from abroad, from such places as he could never really expect to return from, when you think how at first the storms drove him astray over all that expanse of sea. Even the birds take more than a year to cross it, for it is wide and dangerous, too. Off with you at once, ship and crew and all. Or, if you prefer the land, horses and car are at your service. My sons are at your service, and they shall be your guides to lovely Lacedaemon, and there you will find Menelaus. Beg him yourself to tell you the truth, but he will not deceive you, for he knows what is right and proper. When he finished, the sun set and darkness came. Then Athena spoke, with her bright eyes glinting.
"Sir, you have told your tale well. Now then, cut the tongues of sacrifice and mix the wine that we may pour libations to Poseidon and the other immortals, and think of our rest. It is high time now, for the light has gone down into the west, and it is not fitting to sit long at a feast of sacrifice, but to pass on."
The others listened and did as she said. Attendants poured water over their hands, boys filled the mixing bowls to the brim, and served wine to all after pouring in the first drops. They cast the tongues on the fire, and the company, standing, poured out, one after another, the first drops, in honor of the gods. And when the libation was done, and they had drunk as much as they wished, Athena and the handsome lad made as though to return to their ship. But Nestor would not have it. He said at once,
"Zeus and all the immortal gods forbid that you should leave me and go off to your ship, as if I were a pauper without a rag, as if I had not plenty of blankets and rugs in the house, nothing for myself to sleep soft on, nothing for my guests. Come, come, I have blankets and rugs of the best. No, no, that man's son shall not lie on a ship's deck, his very own son, so long as I am alive and while children are left after me to entertain the guests who may come to my house."
Athena answered him,
"That is well said, dear and reverend sir. It is yours to command, and Telemachus must obey, as is right and proper. Well, he shall stay with you and sleep in your mansion. But I will return to our ship to hearten the men and make them do their duty. You see, I am the only man of full years among them. The rest are all of an age with our brave young Telemachus, and come as volunteers out of affection for him. So I will just lie down in the old black ship for this night. But tomorrow I mean to visit the Caconians. Those good fellows owe me a claim, no new thing and no small thing. And our friend here, since he has come to your house, lend him your son and a carriage, and let him go on, and lend him horses, the fastest and strongest you have."
With these words, Athena departed, taking the shape of a sea osprey. All that saw it were amazed. The old man was amazed when he saw this with his own eyes, and he grasped Telemachus by the hand and said,
"My friend, I do not think you will turn out a coward or a craven if in your young days you have gods to escort you. For this is one of those who dwell in Olympus, none other than the very daughter of Zeus, most glorious Titigenea, the same who used to honor your father among our people. Oh, queen, do thou be gracious and grant me an honorable name, myself and my children and my beloved wife. And I, in my turn, will sacrifice to thee a yearling cow, broad-browed, unbroken, which no man has ever brought under the yoke. Such a one I will sacrifice to thee, and cover the horns with gold."
Thus he prayed, and Pallas Athena heard his prayer.
Then Nestor led them all, sons and godsons, to his fine mansion house.
And when they came to the king's house, they sat down in order upon chairs and settles. Then the old king had a mixing bowl filled with delicious wine, 11 years old, when the cellarer cut the cap and opened it. Such was the wine which the old king sent for, and as he sprinkled the sacred drops, he prayed earnestly to Athena, daughter of Zeus Almighty. They poured their drops and drank, and separated, each to his own room, to sleep. But Royal Nestor took Telemachus in hand and left him to sleep there in the echoing gallery, and by his side the famous lancer Pisistratus, a born leader of men, one of his sons who lived in the mansion still unmarried. The king slept himself in a recess of the lofty hall, and there the queen, his wife, prepared bed and bedding. Dawn showed her rosy fingers through the mists of the morning. King Nestor arose from his bed and went out to the smooth stone benches which were before his lofty doors, all white and brightly polished. There in former days had sat Neleus, his father, wise as a god in council. But he long since had yielded to fate and gone down to Hades. And now Nestor sat there as warden of the nation, holding the royal scepter. About him gathered all his sons as they came from their rooms, Echephron and Stratius, Perseus and Aretas, and the young prince Thrasymedes. Last came the sixth, Pisistratus, a fine young fellow, and they led out Telemachus to a seat, looking like a young god. Then Nestor addressed the company.
"Quickly, my dear boys, carry out my wish that I may find favor with Athena first of all the gods, who showed herself manifestly at our rich sacrifice yesterday. Be quick, let one go into the country for the heifer, and let the herdsman in charge drive her in. One go to the ship of brave Telemachus and bring up all his companions, leaving only two. One summon Laerces the goldsmith, that he may cover the heifer's horns with gold. The rest of you stay here together, and tell the women indoors to get ready a good meal in my house, and set the places, and collect the firewood, and bring clean water."
Then they all bustled about. The heifer came from the country. The companions of Telemachus came from their ship. The smith came with all his tackle, the tools of his trade, anvil and hammer and handy tongs, which he used to work the gold. And Athena came to receive the offering.
Old King Nestor provided the gold, and the goldsmith covered the horns, fitting the gold neatly to please the goddess with a handsome sight.
Stratius and young Echephron led the heifer by the horns. Aretas came out of his room, bearing in one hand the jug of water in a bowl worked with a flower pattern, and in the other hand a basket with the sprinkling meal. Thrasymedes, the young soldier, was there, holding a sharp axe to cut down the heifer. Perseus held the bowl for the blood.
Old King Nestor began the rite with hand wash and barley meal, and as he did it, he prayed earnestly to Athena while he cast the forelock into the fire. When they had prayed and sprinkled the barley meal, at once Thrasymedes approached and struck the blow. The axe cut through the sinews of the neck, and the strength went from her. Then all the women raised their alleluia, daughters and sons' wives, and Nestor's honored consort Eurydice, eldest of the daughters of Clymenus. The other sons lifted up the victim from the ground and held it on their shoulders. Pisistratus cut the throat. Then the red blood flowed, and life left the body. So they broke her up forthwith, and cut out the rump slices in proper form, and wrapped them one slice between two pieces of fat, and laid other slices of raw flesh upon these. The old king burnt them upon the faggots, and poured over them sparkling wine. The young men stood by his side, holding their five-pronged forks in their hands. Then, after the rump slices were burnt, and they had divided the tripes, they chopped up the rest and ran the pieces on spits and grilled them, holding the ends of the spits in their hands. Meanwhile, Telemachus had been bathed by Polycasta, the youngest daughter of Nestor Nelides, and when she had bathed him and rubbed him with olive oil, she gave him a wrap and a tunic to wear. Then he stepped out of the tub as handsome as a young god. He came to Nestor's side and sat him down by the king. The others had now roasted the fleshy parts and taken them off the spits, and they were sitting down to their meal. Good men looked after them, pouring out the wine into golden cups. And when they had eaten and drunk all they wanted, old King Nestor addressed them. "My boys, hurry up with the horses and put them under the yoke that he may get on his way."
They did as they were told, with a will. Quickly they put the swift horses under the yoke, and the housekeeper packed in bread and wine and meat such as kings eat by the grace of heaven. Up climbed Telemachus into the splendid car. Beside him was Pisistratus Nestorides, who got into the car and took hold of the reins. He whipped up the horses, and they left the tall castle of Pylos and flew on nothing loath into the plains. So, all day long, they shook the yoke up and down. The sun went down, and all the ways became dark, and they came to Phere, to the house of Diocles, the son of Ortilochus, whose father was the river god Alpheus. There they rested for the night, and he gave them the gifts that were a guest's due. But when dawn showed her rosy fingers again out of the mists, they put the horses to and mounted the car. He whipped up the horses, and the pair flew along. By and by they came to a plain full of growing wheat, and there at last they were near the end of their journey. So well did the swift horses carry them on. The sun went down, and all the ways became